WAMU 88.5 News.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour featuring Tom Sherwood. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the Current newspapers. Welcome, Tom Sherwood.
Welcome. I want to tell you where I just came from before we get to it.
Where did you just come from?
The Armory, the D.C. Armory.
What was going on?
The National Geographic's having a three-day sale of all the stuff they normally sell for really high, expensive prices, cheap. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for a place to go buy a Christmas holiday present, today, Saturday, and Sunday, the Armory, National Geographic.
How did you manage to incorporate that into your workday for which you are paid to do news reporting?
Well, because I'm doing a story about the economy. It's about how people, if you want a, you know, $100 atlas for $22, that's the place to go. And I'm doing a story about it tonight for TV. But I was really impressed, and I bought a couple of things
myself. I was
about
to say, did you happen to purchase anything for you or your friends while you were there?
I did. Well, I bought for my friends, so I didn't have much to buy. And the fact is, I did pay the sales tax, too.
And you expect to get paid by NBC for performing this service for yourself and your friends today? That's how it works in this town. Fortunately for us, our guest analyst spends all his time on the job, actually on the job. Tim Craig is our guest analyst. He's a reporter at the Washington Post. Tim, don't tell me you were down here to buying stuff.
Good morning. Great now, books. Unfortunately, I could not do my Christmas shopping company time this morning, but I was home working on some stories.
Thank you very much for at least working. 800-433-8850 is the number to call if you're not working and would like to join this conversation. Also, you can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org. We now have a new definition, Tom Sherwood, for power washing, which is what happened to the driveway of Council Chairman Vincent Gray. It now means if you get your driveway washed by a very powerful company doing multi-million-dollar business with the District of Columbia.
You know, Chairman Vince Gray, who is setting himself up to run for mayor and complain about how Mayor Finty behaves, has been caught up in this, and we don't know if anything was actually done wrong, but the appearance was bad, that he used a big company, William C. Smith's company, a subsidiary of that, actually a construction
company. When I came to this town in 1969, the William Smith C. Smith Company was one of the biggest landlords
and
in the District of Columbia. Yes.
And so he asked his friend, Chris Smith, said, hey, I'm doing some work around my house.
He's
Chris
the CEO,
Smith
right?
Said, I'll do it, or arranged to have it done. So his company arranged to have three or four subcontractors. I might point out three of those contractors are suburban companies, not D.C. companies. And they fixed his driveway, they washed his driveway, they painted a room, they did some electrical work for TV wiring and other stuff like that. And another firm provided $5,000 worth of architectural planning advice for a $70,000 renovation that hasn't been done. And the question is, did the chairman at least give the appearance of impropriety by dealing on such a personal level with a person who has such business interests with the district? Most people think yes.
The chairman has said that he has a long-standing relationship with the individual involved, going back 15 years or so, and he simply called him up to say, look, I'm trying to have some major work done on my home here. I would like your guidance. As it was, they didn't have to do any major work, and they said, look, we can help you out with a few of these small things here, but you have to, or he said, I did pay for them, and I guess one of the big disputes now is when he paid for them.
Well, that's right. The Washington Times, this was an exclusive story the Washington Times stripped across the front page, and it contends that the bill was not paid until it started asking questions. The chairman says, oh, well, one of the bills was for late October, when I got them all, I paid them. But the fact is that the newspaper was inquiring about this, and then the bill was paid. Whether it was paid because they inquired, I don't know. But it just seems if you're preparing to run for mayor, you would stay away from sticky situations, and that's what it looks like to me.
Well, there's another sticky situation, Tim Craig, in which the council chairman is involved, having to do with a contribution of $10,000 from Comcast to the D.C. Democratic State Committee. But the problem here is that the request from Comcast was made on city council stationery by Council Chairman Vincent Gray. That's your story. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this all stems from last summer as the D.C. Democrats were preparing to go to Denver for the national convention. And the Democratic Party set up a committee to raise money to help pay for delegate expenses at the convention, pay for parties, and also promote the issue of voting rights. They plan to raise several hundred thousand dollars for this endeavor, and they teamed with city council members to help to try to raise some money from corporate and other business interests around the city. Vince Gray, it has been determined, sent out a letter last August on his official letterhead, kind of almost demanding that Comcast contribute to this effort. It was pretty stern language saying, yes, we expect you to contribute $20,000 to help pay for this effort on his official letterhead. Turns around, Comcast gave $10,000. $5,000 also came from the Cable Television Political Action Committee. And Vince Gray admits he made a mistake, that he should have never did that on his official letterhead, although he claims also that part of the reason why he went down that route is that he kind of saw it as an official solicitation, because they were also going to be promoting the issue of voting rights, which is a priority for the city.
Again, the number to call is 800-433-8850, or you can go to facebook.com/Kojo Show and ask a question or make a comment there. When a Congress member is found with $90,000 in his freezer, everybody understands that that looks very suspicious. I think some people would have a difficulty understanding. If Council Chairman Gray had written that identical letter on D.C. Democratic State Committee stationery, even making the same kinds of demands, would it technically have been different, and would it therefore have been legal and proper?
Well, there's another issue besides just the stationery. The council chairman was requesting $20,000, even though most politicians in the city should know that there's a $5,000 limit on how much anyone can give a political committee. So he was requesting three times what the legal limit were for a contribution, and Comcast actually gave twice the legal limit, that money that will now likely have to be refunded in some way, or may have already been refunded. And this is all caught up in a broader issue about why the D.C. Democratic Party set up a committee, and they never reported it to anyone. They didn't report it to the Federal Election Commission, which convention accounts maybe should have been reported to. They didn't report it to the local D.C. Board of Elections. So a lot of critics, including some within the party, say this essentially was a slush fund where these politicians and local Democratic leaders thought they could just raise unlimited amounts of money from whoever they wanted to and not have to tell anyone about it.
I've looked into a little of this. I talked to David Meadows from this party, and Tim, maybe you know more about this, but one of the contentions by the party is that it set up a nonprofit entity, that this was it wasn't the Democratic State Committee, but it was set up as a nonprofit, which I think they thought put it outside the politics. I don't know if it does or not.
That's what they thought, but the Board of Elections and the Office of Campaign Finance has since rolled in a series of preliminary audits that no, this money has to be reported somewhere, and they should have had to abide by the rules.
So setting up a nonprofit it doesn't give them cover to ask for the money.
As somebody said to me this week, in this day and age, for anyone who knows anything about politics to think that they could raise unlimited amounts of money and not report it anywhere and just kind of do whatever they want with it, really hasn't been paying attention to what's been going on out there.
We wanted to go to the convention. We had work to do. We wanted to party. We figured we could set up a nonprofit, and that would avoid all of the reporting regulations that there were.
Well, I would just say this about the local Democratic State Committee. It has been a place for internal battles endlessly. I can't remember the last time when the party took a stand on a public policy issue. And as opposed to fighting over who's the chairman, who's going to do this, who's going to do that, and maybe this will be a wake-up call.
Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter. He's also a columnist for the current newspapers. Our guest analyst today is Tim Craig, who is a reporter at the Washington Post. Here's Katie in Foggy Bottom. Katie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. It seems like the D.C. Council is refusing to enforce any type of ethics law. And due to council chairman's very unethical behavior, I'm feeling like it's time for him to step down. Do you think that'll happen, and when?
Well, here's Tim Craig.
Well, I mean, I don't think Vince Gray thinks there's any need for him to step down at the moment. But the caller does raise an interesting point. If you look this year, we've had the Marion Barry situation with revelations that he gave a city contract to a lady he's been romantically involved with. We've had the questions surrounding the arrest of Jim Graham's chief of staff. Now we have this latest with Council Chairman Gray. And then, of course, there's been plenty of also questions raised about the ethical conduct of things on the executive branch as well. So all this put together raises a very interesting question going into the 2010 elections is, are we starting to reach a saturation point where residents are a little bit fed up and whether all politicians who are on the ballot next year need to be a little bit worried of, you know.
Katie, how do you feel about the incidents involving the executive, as Tim Craig put it, Mayor Adrian Fenty, about his quote-unquote ethical problems? Katie, don't run out on me now.
I think she
might
be listening. But, you know, the chairman, while you try to resuscitate the caller there, you know, the chairman has proposed an ethics law for the council. And also, you know, the Congress is moving. It said on the Hatch Act, there will be a local Hatch Act. There's going to be a lot of ethics reform legislation. And I think these incidences that Tim just enumerated will make sure there are no loopholes in the law. But it hasn't been done yet.
On to Jason in Friendship Heights. Katie apparently didn't want to comment on the mayor. Jason, your turn.
Yeah, I'm here.
Go right ahead, Jason.
My question is, you know, Chairman Gray violated the D.C. Code, raised money for the Democratic Party, and he did it while using council resources. Do you think that's going to hurt his chances when he tries to unseat Mayor Fenty?
Yes.
Well, you know, if he wants to be the avenging angel candidate against Mayor Fenty for whatever he's done wrong, well, then it's hard to be the avenging angel when there's smudges on your wings.
The question is, of course, Jason, how much it will hurt him, because as Tim Craig has pointed out, Mayor Fenty has had some ethical challenges of his own, so that's likely to be raised in the campaign. Also, I don't know if it would hurt him enough to either A, cause him to decide not to go in the race at all, or if he did enter the race, if it would be enough to cause him a significant amount of votes that would cause him to lose the race. But yes, it is likely to hurt at least a little bit. Thank you very much for your call. You too can call us at 800-433-8850 or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. The Catholic Archdiocese has said that the city council would force it to end its social services contract with the city if the council moves forward with a plan to legalize the performance of gay marriages here in Washington. Joining us now is David Catania. He's a member of the D.C. City Council, an independent who holds an at-large seat. He's also chairman of the council's Committee on Health. Councilman Catania, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you, Kojo. Good to be here.
It seems that the Catholic Archdiocese and the city council are playing a game of political chicken. It's my understanding that you've suggested that Catholic Charities adopt a policy similar to the one in place at Georgetown University that gives benefits to some same-sex couples. Could you please explain?
That's right. Look, I don't believe that we're playing a game of chicken with the Archdiocese. I think Councilmember Mendelson and I are trying to help them reconcile the false choice which Catholic Charities has put out there, which is if they're required to follow the law, they'll take their ball and go home. And they do not want to be able or forced to have to provide insurance benefits for the lawfully married spouses of same-sex couples. So what we've suggested they do is to follow the lead of what was the former Archbishop of San Francisco, William Levada, who worked with Mayor Willie Brown in San Francisco over 10 years ago to reach a similar compromise. And the compromise essentially there, and that which is adopted at Georgetown University, doesn't force the church to recognize any marriage at all. It simply says, in the context of employee benefits, they can provide benefits for spouses they recognize, or alternatively provide one legally domiciled adult in the household of the particular employee the same benefits of a spouse. And so it is a bit of mental gymnastics to help accommodate their deeply held belief that marriage is between a man and a woman, and also the city's right when we are a purchaser of goods and services to demand that our vendors treat individuals under our Human Rights Act equally. I think it's a fair compromise, and I look forward to the Archdiocese and Catholic Charities response.
We had the head of the Catholic Charities organization, Ed Orzechowski, on earlier this week, and I found it difficult to understand the distinction that Catholic Charities makes between the city's regulations on domestic partners, which I assume the Catholic Church, since these individuals are not married, disapproves of also, and the city's probably upcoming gay marriage law. The Catholic Charity said the domestic partners law didn't prohibit from prohibited either from offering services or benefits, but the gay marriage law would.
Well, right now they don't provide domestic partnership benefits at all.
And they don't have to. They're a private organization.
Right. Well, that's right. And we don't have a law similar to San Francisco, which requires city vendors to provide equal benefits. That is not the law as it is in San Francisco. But again, I think the false choice raised by the Archdiocese is important because since July 7th of this year, there have been lawfully married same-sex couples in the district. So the notion that simply performing the ceremonies here has caused this issue is really disingenuous. Today, Catholic Charities is required to provide equal benefits to its same-sex and opposite-sex couples. If you're going to provide the benefit, then you have to provide it equally. And so that problem exists today. And they've somehow bootstrapped the council's initiative to have them solemnized here, marriages solemnized here, as forcing the issue. What Councilmember Mendelson and I did, we researched what happened in San Francisco, we researched what's going on 37th and O in Georgetown, and we're trying to provide them an option on how they can go forward consistent with their deeply held religious beliefs and also be consistent with the law. I think we're trying to be constructive in finding a solution, and I wish and hope that they'll see it that way.
Why can't they just take the position that render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and that's if they follow the laws and then do what they want inside their church?
Well, so long as they are entirely privately funded, I think that is absolutely the case, and I think that's your point. But the fact of the matter is a substantial part of Catholic Charities' resources comes from district taxpayers. And when you willingly enter into the public forum of accepting public money, you run the risk of having to live under the laws that are passed by a secular government, and that includes the equal non-discriminatory treatment of our residents. I am mindful and respectful of religious freedom and worked for several months to try to craft a bill that I thought captured and expanded religious freedom and protected it. The day that the Archbishop Wuerl announced his opposition to same-sex marriage, I initiated a call to him and explained my desire to work with him to further perfect this bill. We have then met with the Chancellor of the Archdiocese and staff, and I have the email traffic to prove it, where we have asked them to provide us specific language that they could live with. They have declined at every opportunity to provide us the specific legislative language they can live with. And so I feel a little like I'm negotiating against myself, but nonetheless, I think it's important that we negotiate in good faith and that we try to find solutions to our common problems.
Yeah,
and
that's here's Tim Craig.
Yeah, I think one thing people are confused about, and you may be able to clarify, is if the same-sex marriage bill passes, will every business and organization in the city have to provide the same benefits to married gay couples that they provide to married heterosexual couples?
That's right. Right. That's exactly it. And that is the law today. We have lawfully married same-sex couples in the district who've gone outside of the city, been married in return. So if you are going to provide a benefit, nothing in our law requires you to provide spousal benefits. Nothing in our law requires you to provide insurance benefits. But if you are going to provide them for a class of people, a class of married people, you have to provide them on an equal basis. Domestic partnership is slightly different because many organizations don't provide domestic partnership benefits, and by the way, they apply to opposite and same-sex couples in the district.
But if you are providing them,
they must be provided on an equal basis.
On to the telephones. Here is Craig in Baltimore, Maryland. Craig, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks a lot. I just wanted to point out that the Archdiocese, the Catholic Church, doesn't recognize a whole slew of marriages between men and women, specifically if a couple is divorced, which the church doesn't recognize, and then one or both of them remarries, then that second marriage is not viewed as a marriage by the church. Nevertheless, they don't pick and choose among employees that your spouse will not receive spousal benefits because you were divorced and we don't approve of your second marriage. So they're taking a class of marriages they don't recognize, the same-sex marriages, and saying among the marriages we don't recognize, the gay partners are the ones we're going to exclude. Other partners, even though we don't recognize your marriage, will pay you benefits.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call.
I think that's an important point that he makes, that divorce is a regular thing. And if you are, as I understand it, not being Catholic, if you're divorced, you cannot participate in the church sacraments. But if you're an employee of the church, and you're divorced and you remarry, then your partner gets the benefits.
May I
assumed you were Catholic after you started quoting Roman history about rendering unto Caesar and all of this.
Just to be for the record, I'm Seventh-day agnostic.
just so if I might, in all seriousness, we are looking to try to find a constructive solution that accomplishes the issue of the employee benefit issue. As I understand it, the second issue left unresolved concerns the church's unwillingness to engage in adoptive services for same-sex married couples. And I think we can find a solution to that as well. And the solution, unfortunately, is of the 102 ward-based adoptions in the district last year, 6 were performed by Catholic Charities. It may be that they just will no longer be in the business of publicly subsidized case management for adoptions. They can continue to do all the private adoptions they want, but when it comes to publicly funded adoptions case management, we may just have to fill in for those 6 that they provided last year.
But back up just a second, because it is my understanding that before we even talked anything about gay marriage, that people who were lesbians or homosexuals could adopt or have foster children.
Absolutely.
And that if you discriminated against them, even now you would be in violation of the law anyway.
That is unlitigated. That is an unlitigated aspect of our human rights ordinance. Up until now, no gay or lesbian has actually sued the Catholic Church or Catholic Charities on that subject. And I think if they did, it would be reasonable to interpret the human rights ordinance as that being impermissible discrimination. But can I also tell you that Catholic Charities regulation of adoption is very restrictive, and it's not just against gays and lesbians. No non-Christian is allowed to adopt using publicly funded case management through Catholic Charities. You are specifically required to be a member of a Christian church for 2 years prior to being eligible for this case management system that is publicly funded. So that is exclusive as well.
Well, once that hasn't been challenged in court, as you said, it's
that hasn't. There's a third element the church is upset about, too, and it says that if this law were to pass, then its facilities, its parishes, are made available to the public for wedding ceremonies, then it would then be forced to allow gay marriage.
And we amended that in committee so that, just to be abundantly clear, that would not be the case and that they would be immune from liability if sued under equal access to their facilities.
That's a concession by you.
Absolutely, because as I said, when I called the Archbishop and on the day that he announced his opposition, I meant to extend a hand for us to work collaboratively and cooperatively.
Do you ever see getting to a point where the Archdiocese and you and the rest of the council would be able to stand together and say we have reached the solution, or are you just so far apart on this issue? And the Catholic Church, the ultimate goal was not to have same-sex marriage in the district at all. I don't believe they've amended that at all since this whole thing has begun. So is this sort of, is there an end game for this right now?
Well, let me share with you part of the conversation I had with Archbishop Wuerl. And I said, look, this is going to be a bad chapter in a good book. Speaking for my office in particular and the city in general, we have worked well with the Archdiocese and Catholic Charities for a long time, and we will continue in the future. This is an issue on which we disagree. I respect a religious institution's ability to be
the religious architect. Institution educated you at the
that's correct
the undergraduate and the graduate level and, Georgetown
and,
University.
And they have found a way to provide equal benefits, right?
Yeah.
I respect that, but at the same time, this is not a theocracy. We are running a secular government that has an obligation and a duty to treat its citizens equally, and we have to find that our public space is big enough to accommodate both important principles.
The next battleground is quickly the Congress. Eleanor Holmes Norton weighed in this week saying that she wants the church and the city to be on the same page so there won't be any attack on this bill on Capitol Hill. How do you see that now?
Well, again, I think Tim's point is accurate. I gave the chancellor of the Archdiocese, when she came to meet with me, I was very clear. I said, I will concede whatever you need on the issue of religious freedom if the church will concede and support our right as a civil, secular government to extend equal rights to our citizens. And the response was no. And so I said, so I understand this. You want me to have a greater appreciation and sensitivity for your religious freedoms than you do for the role of secular government.
On Capitol Hill, this is going to...
I expect that there will be an effort to undo our work on Capitol Hill. But we're in this for the long haul.
David Catania is a member of the D.C. City Council. He's an independent. He holds an at-large seat. He's also chairman of the Council's Committee on Health. Tim Craig is our guest analyst. He's a reporter at the Washington Post. And Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He is a columnist for the Current Newspapers and an NBC4 reporter. Speaking of the Committee on Health, the city is fighting off threats on a different front this week. The Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development is threatening to cut off funding for the district if its problems at its HIV/AIDS program are not fixed. You're holding a hearing today. You have vowed to haul city officials in before the council every Friday until the problems are fixed. What answers are you looking for?
Well, Coach, we actually had our first hearing on Tuesday, and I demanded that certain material be produced. Actually, on Monday, we had our first hearing. I demanded that we have materials produced within 24 hours. Much of that was produced. I reached out and received a meeting with the Assistant Secretary of HUD in charge of community development and planning, and we met with her and her staff for 2 hours on Wednesday. And we developed exactly and precisely what the list of demands are from HUD. I'm pleased to say that the list has been shrunk to about 6 items. They don't involve, misappropriation. They don't involve nefarious acts. It's simply a matter of paperwork. And we are sometimes our own worst enemy. When our federal partners extend a hand in working with us, they ask for certain paperwork. We need to give it to them the way they want it. What I'm very excited about, and I want to publicly thank Assistant Secretary Marquez for her offer and our acceptance of 2 years of technical assistance with respect to helping us get our systems in order. We will have a hearing today, at which point I think most of these items that were the subject of Wednesday's discussion with HUD will be addressed. There are 2 outstanding. They've given us 30 days to completely respond. We'll have it done in half the time. We'll take advantage of their technical assistance offer. And we're going to go forward, I think very positively. But I want to be clear, our HUD funding is not in jeopardy. The situation is under control.
Tom, Tim, no questions on
well,
that?
Will we ever come to a time where the HIV/AIDS office works without a crisis every 6 months?
Well, I spent my morning before staff of the House Government Reform Committee from majority and minority staff. And while there have been recent publications about the HIV/AIDS administration, and I appreciate and respect the work the Post has done, many of these stories are old stories. Of the 5 vendors that are raised as a crisis flag were raised on the 5, 4 no longer do business with the city. 1 remains in a much diminished capacity. 4 years ago, when I became chair of this committee, there had not been a hearing on HIV/AIDS in memory. I have had more than 20 in the last 4 years. We've addressed the following items in the last 4 years. We couldn't pay our bills 4 years ago in any time closer than 6 months. We now pay 90% of our bills in 30 days. We had no data and research, no epidemiology at all to know where this epidemic was spreading. We contracted with George Washington University School of Public Health. We now have the best data in the country. We've totally revamped the way in which we approach grants management and oversight. I'm not suggesting we're out of the woods, but even the Inspector General, who was with me this morning, an independent arm of this government, stated that he rarely says this, but he is cautiously optimistic, and he points to the council oversight and the work of this administration over the last 4 years. A lot of the stuff that is coming out now in the Post, if you read it carefully, ends in the first quarter of 2008. It took us some time to get the back office of HA straight, paying bills, monitoring people, etc. But we are coming out of that, and I think we're on the verge of being able to play offense with this particular administration.
Tim?
No, I was just saying a broader point that's from the council perspective, but there have been some criticism about whether Mayor Fenty has taken the HIV/AIDS crisis serious enough during his tenure. I know we have, 3% of the population now is estimated to have HIV/AIDS. How do you think the administration has responded to this?
He's been accused of not being visibly enough or active enough.
I think individuals will make up their own mind about the mayor's involvement. I think the best thing he did was 2 years ago hire Shannon Hader in October of 2007. And, I take a constructive approach with Dr. Vigilance and with Dr. Hader. We are working together. Even though we have a lot of hearings, the point is we are working together all the time to try to address these issues. Nothing is to be gained by a combative, hostile environment. Nothing is to be gained by acrimony and a fist fight. What we need, there's a role for the legislature and a role for the executive, and we have been working together to remedy what has been, the collective failure of 2 decades of ignorance and indifference towards this this chronic disease.
There's a public campaign right now to warn and caution better health prevention, all of that. But one of the criticisms is the mayor is not out in front of that campaign either, with his well-known knowledge. You know, their bus ads are, you know, ages are Katrina and all these other kind of ads. But where's the mayor leading that charge?
Well, can I tell you what's exciting about that, about our targeted marketing now? I mentioned earlier, and it's kind of dull inside the park stuff, but we did not have the epidemiology data. We did not know where this epidemic was spreading. So we couldn't take our limited prevention dollars and target for those populations. The new Get the Test campaign and the other work we're doing is strategically targeted towards those populations of emerging infection. And I think the best person to ask with about, you know, the mayor and his role would be the mayor.
And we will do that when we have the mayor here on this broadcast. David Catania is a member of the D.C. Council. He's an independent. He has an at-large seat. He's chairman of the Council's Committee on Health. And even as he deplores acrimony and fistfights, he should understand that that's the fuel that drives the politics hour. So please try to work up some acrimony, maybe a fistfight.
Well, in my defense, when I was younger, I did a lot of it. And I had 41 realized that wasn't the productive approach and that there's much more to be had and much more success to be gathered through conciliatory, constructive.
He's
engagement.
Less fun to watch on the diet dais now up there. He's got a little gray hair, such
but,
as it is.
No
so
hair.
You're saying we
no
need
hair.
Some younger, more
well,
combative
you know,
people on the city council?
Loud.
David Catania, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Koja.
You're listening to The Politics Hour featuring Tom Sherwood, who is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the Current Newspapers. Our guest analyst today is Tim Craig. He is a reporter at The Washington Post. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Here is Susan in Washington, D.C. Susan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I heard you earlier asking a caller what she thought about the ethics violations of Fenty.
Yes, she was essentially denouncing Council Chairman Gray.
Right, and my attitude is, and this may sound, you know, not so good, but my attitude is, I think a lot of people in the district just agree with him and a lot of things that he's trying to do, and are more willing to give him a pass. Almost sort of like it's okay to have a dictator if you agree with his policies. And I just think what he's trying to do with the school and Michelle Rhee and so many things that he's doing or at least trying to do and fighting the sort of the good fight, I have to say, with some of this stuff, I'm just totally willing to look the other way. And
I'm glad you brought that up,
Susan. I
wildly
hope he gets elected. I am the biggest cheerleader that you can imagine.
Susan, I'm glad you brought that up. It allows me to ask our analysts, Tim Craig and Tom Sherwood, in this ongoing battle over the contracts that were let to the Department of Parks and Recreation, which members of the city called illegal and insisted they go before the council for review. The other side of that coin, enunciated by Jack Evans in one of the hearings last week, is that you have already under construction in several neighborhoods projects that are going to be stopped, projects that neighborhoods have been waiting for a long time, and you'll have residents saying, so what, you're going to stop and give these contracts to somebody else while we just wait around to see what happens here?
That raises the interesting point of, had this incident just been about who got the projects done, this very much may have been a one-day or minor story. But the other piece of that was who got the contracts. Several of the mayor's close friends and associates got the contracts with apparently really a no-bid process, and that raises a new dynamic. But the caller's broader point is a good one, because as we enter this new election season, you know, a lot of people who work in the Wilson Building who are around there get all caught up in all these scandals and this going on. But I tend to think a lot of people don't pay attention to a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
They see that the parks, there's been
exactly.
a huge explosion in new parks and ball fields and all that
schools.
Stuff.
People can
schools
see it, they
seem
can
to be getting
it.
A little bit better. The city as a whole is not getting worse, which after the history of the city of the one in the 80s and the early 90s, that says a lot right there. And I think whoever runs against the mayor is going to have a hard time making the case. Not impossible, but it's going to be a hard time making the case that he should be replaced for all this other stuff. When what
people
they
like
see
Susan
is,
are going to say, scrutinize future contracts. Don't stop this work that's going on
well,
right
that's
now.
That's true. People do like the improvement in the school buildings, and Alan Liu gets a lot of credit for that, but under the mayor's administration. I mean, he can campaign by saying, I may have stumbled here, and I have flaws there, but I have been the reformer I promised to be, and the question is, do you want to go forward, or do you want to go back and go back to some other person who's, you know, Don Peebles is thinking about running, you know, the developer. And he's going to decide in the next few weeks what to do probably. And if he runs, talking to him recently, you know, the issue will be he's got his start under Marion Barry. That's going to be a tough sell for a lot of people, even though he has gone on to be a successful businessman and other things. And Vince Gray has to show that he could do better things that Fenty has done, despite the flaws. It's going to be a tough campaign.
Don't underestimate, the mayor still has a certain amount of star quality around him. I saw him at the Adams Morgan Day Festival, which was probably like 6 weeks ago now. Yeah. And he was mobbed by people coming up wanting Fenty stickers, or wanting pictures taken with him, or you know them to sign their shirt. I mean, he still has a little bit of that touch that he had back in the 2006 campaign.
It's that ball thing that you guys have.
What this person just said, actually, in some ways, irritation. Why is the mayor being so petty about the baseball tickets? Why is the mayor, you know, riding his bike with the police? Why is he doing those little things when he's doing such a good job otherwise? And I think that's a very high hurdle for a challenger to overcome.
The Metro Board yesterday ordered agency employees to cooperate with the system's oversight body. The Washington Post reporting last week that Metro executives had barred independent monitors from walking along live tracks to observe safety procedures. Joining us now in the studio is Chris Zimmerman. He's a member of the Arlington County Board. He's a Democrat. He's also a member of the board of directors of the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, Metro. Chris Zimmerman, welcome. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Chris, the Tri-State Oversight Committee, the Metro board members had not heard of it before the crash that occurred this past June.
And some had not.
Some had not. Oh, I thought it was no member had heard of it. But I am still a little bewildered as to exactly who the Tri-State Oversight Committee is and who its members report to. Because in the Washington Post reporting, it said that the chairman of the committee said that there was no protocol for him picking up the phone and calling the chair of the Metro Board and saying, look, these people won't let us onto the tracks. Who is the Tri-State Oversight Committee?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say it's been a very obscure body that has only existed for a little over a decade. It was created in 1997, so about 12 years ago. And it was a new federal regulation that required state safety oversight committees where there were urban rail systems. And so there are a number of them, something like 27 or 28 of them around the country that have been established under this. Now, in most places, that means they're in one state. So it's a body that's reporting to the state overseeing the local rail system. Well, in a few places in the country, there are more than one state involved. There's actually three of these. But the other two involve two states. Ours involves three, with Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia. And that is part of the problem.
So you have two members from each jurisdiction on this committee. And I don't...
Do they have an office? Where are they?
Well, yeah, that's the problem. They have no office. Right. They have no staff. They have no website, although they are actually getting one posted on the D.C. website. But all that just illustrates the fact that when this was set up, the system really was not very robust, to use the term that the head of the National Transportation Safety Board used earlier this week. It wasn't a very serious commitment, I'd say, and I think that's been revealed. There was a GAO report about 3 years ago that looked at the system all across the country and, you know, identified a number of problems and specifically looked at the Tri-State Oversight Committee, or TOC, here. Which has particular problems because of this arrangement. It's kind of a motherless child. You know, it doesn't really belong to anybody.
And are these members paid? Are they really volunteers?
Well, they're not volunteers. They're assigned by the individual state departments of transportation. So the two Virginians, for instance, are from the Virginia Department of Rail and Public Transportation. There's two from Maryland. Similarly, they're reporting to their state transportation departments. They're essentially, and you know, my impression from having met them now for the first time, at least two of them, they're very earnest professionals trying to do a good job. They're also people relatively far down in the organization. They don't have a lot of authority within their own organization. And one of the things that our discussion yesterday at the committee meeting revealed is, you know, they didn't feel empowered even to, you know, push the ball up on their own side. You know, so, you know, I mean, a lot of us were wondering, you know, number one, why wouldn't this committee have sent a board to the, you know, a letter to the Metro Board saying, hey, guys, we're going to have a problem with your staff. But even failing that, you know, why wouldn't they have contacted the FTA, who they're ultimately responsible to, or their own departments? And I think the answer is that, you know, these are people who are, you know, are good professionals, are used to working within the organization, and, you know, they try to cooperate and solve things cooperatively, you know, which is fine, except, of course, that if you want real strong oversight, you have to have somebody empowered to make a phone call to the person on top and say, hey, there's a problem here. And that clearly hasn't been happening.
How do we move ahead?
Well, we've pushed for a couple of things. The board yesterday approved three actions. One, of course, aimed at our own staff, which said, yes, you will cooperate with the Tri-State Oversight Committee. And if you have a problem with one of their requests, then you tell us right away. And, you know, I think that's a large part of what needs to be done to prevent what happened over the last 6 months. But we also sent... we also directed that a letter be sent to the state secretaries of transportation who are responsible for the talk more directly to suggest a number of ways in which this system could be strengthened, including providing them with some more funding so they actually have some staff capability, and so that and to try and elevate it within their agencies so that the people who serve in that know they're empowered to at least call the secretary on their end and say there's a problem. And thirdly, we adopted a resolution that I proposed that calls for a federal oversight effort. I saw in the paper that there's a that the Obama administration may be proposing legislation in this area. If they do, I think it needs to be enacted quickly.
What would that legislation really need?
A national approach. Well, for one thing, I think it would set national standards on many things.
But would there be management oversight, or just somebody looking at what you're doing?
Well, I think that you need first of all to have the ability for everyone to know that if we're saying something's safe, that's always a matter of degree, right? Nothing's ever perfectly safe, but you want to know that it's as safe as it can possibly be, which usually means you're meeting some kind of standards. So you have to know that there actually are standards that are set on a larger level and not just by the people who are running a particular system. And then you need to know that somebody on the outside is looking at it and saying, yeah, this is okay. They get the stamp of approval. You know, you get that, for instance, on the financial side. If you ask me, are Metro's books good? You're not just counting on the staff who run it to say that. We have outside audits that say, yep, in fact, their books are okay. And so you need that kind of process here. If you look at things like airlines and heavy rail, those are regulated in that way at the federal level. I mean, there's tremendous effort to making sure that the 600 million or so, passengers who fly in, the skies every year know that the airlines are being run as safely as possible. Well, 10 billion people ride transit, right. And there's no effort like that.
If there's more federal oversight, would that mean maybe more federal money down the road?
Well, I think the feds are going to have to fund it if they're going to do it, clearly. There's going to need to be funding for this effort just as there is for airlines and, say, heavy rail.
If you have questions for Metro board member Chris Zimmerman, you can call us at 800-433-8850 or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Here's Tim Craig.
Now, just question whether the federal standards, have they already applied for like the MARC train in Maryland and the VRE in Virginia? And if so, they did not apply for the Metro, but they applied for those systems?
Right.
Heavy rail?
Well, commuter rail lines like VRE and MARC run on the major heavy rail corridor, the CSX, Norfolk Southern lines, the freight rail lines. So they come under the regulation of the Federal Railroad Administration, which is a different body than the Federal Transit Administration. So the Federal Railroad Administration, is empowered, has funding and all to establish those kind of criteria and do that kind of oversight. The Federal Transit Administration has never had that ability. In fact, I think has been explicitly stopped by the legislation that created it in the first place in the 1960s, before which time the feds weren't involved in this area at all. So essentially what we need is something parallel. It's not going to be exactly the same, but something equivalent in terms of an effort to FRA and FAA oversight.
And when do you guys think you'll be able to come up for air in the aftermath of the accident? And then you had these series of stories in the Washington Post, and it seemed like this is just continuing. When's the Metro board and the Metro system going to be back where you can kind of put that all behind you?
Well, obviously it's been a very difficult year. Something like what happened on June 22nd, and there really has never been anything like what happened on June 22nd. It's very wrenching and traumatic for everyone in the organization. As a result, there are a lot of consequences. When do you ever get past that? Well, for one thing, we have to be able to, run with confidence again the way we did before. It's going to mean things like, when can we go back to automatic train control, which obviously our passengers would like, our system would run better. But we can't do that until we have a safety system in place that ensures that there's just no chance that what happened on June 22nd could occur again. And as you no doubt heard, that system doesn't exist anywhere in the industry. So it has to be developed now, which they're working on. And hopefully we can come up with something that can be implemented fairly quickly. That's one of the kinds of steps that would give everybody more confidence, not only passengers, but the people actually are operating the system. Because, I think they're affected by this too.
How serious is the downturn in ridership, either for the safety reasons or for the economy reasons, that there are fewer riders or the growth is not as robust as it was?
Well, obviously, the tremendous period of growth that we had, which was dramatic for such a long period of time, has essentially has come to a stop, or at least a pause. The reasons for that, are multifold, starting with the economy. When the economy goes down, travel goes down, and vehicle miles traveled, that car travel was falling already, and transit ridership was still going up. With the aftermath of the accident, the biggest effect of that was losing a substantial portion of the capacity on the heaviest line in the system. So we just had less capacity for a long time. We're only beginning to see that restored. And to some degree, there's still a little bit less because of the slower way you're operating. So some of that is involved there. On the other hand, though, we still have very heavy ridership, and although it may not be rising the way it was, it's not a substantial fall. If you fall a percent or two, that obviously can have revenue implications. But we're still carrying an awful lot of people every day.
Here's Joseph in Rockville, Maryland. Joseph, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. I'm one of these anecdotal items. I have been a proponent of the Metro and loved it and recommended it to people coming in from out of town and for my family as my boy's been growing up. However, I was appalled to find after the last that major accident that my assumptions that base engineering principles like no single, no point of failure and other items were actually not being followed at the Metro. When I have gone backside of the Metro to visit restrooms and other things, it's clear that outside of the facade there's a huge amount of crime, debris, and probably other issues that are occurring. How can I, as a member of the traveling public, get transparent visibility into the engineering design and safety elements of the system so I can be assured that we not only have the system that says, oh, a car is on this track, but hey, a car entered it and it exited it, so it's actually going through there. It sounds like a very basic system design problem that I would have expected to have been in place 2 decades ago.
Chris Zimmerman?
Well, of course, this goes to my point that if you have an external oversight body, you can provide validation. So somebody with that question doesn't just have to ask me, to rely on me to say, yes, it's safe.
They can go to a well-resourced tri-state oversight committee.
Well, exactly. Or, and preferably with some federal standard so that you can say, there are national standards for these things and they are being met here. And that's been certified by somebody who should know. But let me say, overall, I understand the concerns that the writer expressed. I write it myself. I wrote it to get here. So obviously, I'm in the same position to think about those things. I do believe that riding Metro Rail is probably the single safest way you can travel, notwithstanding any of these issues. I mean, if you just look at it in any kind of statistical fashion, I don't think there's a safer way to travel. And I think that, when you look at a specific issue like what occurred, the fact that it is so rare reflects the fact that there are, in fact, many safety measures in place. The question is, when you're running millions and millions of times, you have to have an extremely high rate of security in order to never have something happen. And, clearly there's a failure point that has to be dealt with. And, I have no doubt that it's going to be in this case. But the question is, how can you be sure that there's not something else? And that, brings me back to the point that, I think we need more of an effort to provide everyone with that assurance, notwithstanding the fact that the record on the whole is, in fact, very strong. On all aspects of safety and security.
Joseph, thank you very much for your call.
Short of safety, he did mention the experience of riding Metro, whether it's cleanliness of facilities and things like that. I would tell you the biggest complaint I ever hear from people talking about Metro is the rowdiness of teenagers in the schools in the afternoon at the Tenley or Southwest stop or any other stop where people get on. They say there's no management of the places at that time of day, whether the staff stay inside those little bubbles or there are no police officers. It's just too chaotic, and you're told, avoid the subway in the early afternoon.
Yeah, I've heard
Metro
about that, too.
Metro has tranquilizers for the teenage brain?
Well, what we do have is an effort that's underway under the leadership of Chief Taborn of our police department who has been working very assiduously to try and address those issues. They occur in certain parts of the system at certain times, as you said, and I know it's a concern. It is something being worked on. The broader issue there that goes to, overall who's at the stations, who's helping out, and what are they doing, I think that is an issue. I've always thought that, our station managers need to be a real part of the of the solution to this and need to be the face of Metro in a very affirmative way and hopefully a very positive way, assisting customers in one way or another. And I think we can do more there. That's one of the things we've tried to bring some more attention to. Overall, though, whether it's these operational issues like having people there who can help or dealing with cleanliness or dealing with the overall questions of safety that have to do with how the system functions, it does all come down to, are we going to invest the kind of money that is necessary to do that? And that's a problem because we have not adequately invested in our system.
Go ahead.
No, I just said, does it seem like, you know, any new investment will be coming? I mean, the match, has Virginia finally went through with their match, share the match that was required?
Talking about for the additional
million.
Federal money?
Yeah, yeah.
For the additional federal funds from the bill that has not yet passed Congress. Mm-hmm. Virginia already committed to $50 million. Right. As far as I know, Maryland and the district will do the same. Right now, both the House and the Senate.
D.C. has, I believe.
And so what it's really down to is the Congress going to pass the appropriations bill that in the House and Senate versions, they each have put the money in. But, of course, it has to go through, conference committee and, you know, come out in the same form. The appropriations bill hasn't passed yet. If it does, that'll help. We'll have an extra $300 million. But that's still far short of what's necessary.
How about your level of confidence in Metro head John Cato? There's the issue of the Metro safety chief apparently not informing John Cato that she had been denying access to the Tri-State Oversight Committee. And now there's the controversy over the changes in the Smart Trip benefits program having to be put off for at least a year because writers say they were both unfair and confusing.
Well, those are two very different things. So on the first item, we spent a lot of time yesterday on that, and I still have real questions. I think they were reflected in the resolution that was passed about exactly what's going on. And I think the board's given pretty clear direction on this. I think that direction is consistent with what the general manager has said he expects policy to be. And so anyone in the organization should know the board is behind the general manager in this. I have confidence in him. We want to make sure that the organization is doing what he expects and what the board has directed. The smart benefits issue is a little bit different. That's a situation where for some time now, I mean, it's a number of years, Metro has had to respond to requirements of the IRS.
Always going after the little people.
Yeah, the combination of the IRS regulations and the way the system works for fair collection and payment and all that has, you know, presented quite a challenge, let's say. And the way that it was proposed originally obviously created a lot of problems about which, you know, we heard from writers. And so, you know, the board said, what is it that we have to do? And, you know, can we get any, you know, flexibility from the IRS? Staff's apparently gone back and gotten an opportunity for delay so we can try to come up with something that works better for employers and employees.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Chris Zimmerman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Zimmerman is a member of the Arlington County Board. He's a Democrat and a member of the Board of Directors of the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. Tim Craig, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Tim is a reporter at the Washington Post. Tom Sherwood, always a pleasure.
Thank you. Don't forget the National Geographic sale.
Tom is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the current newspapers when he's not buying stuff at the National Geographic sale. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, respected colleagues in the workplace or second-class citizens, Howard Ross is back to explore what happens when temp or contract employees